Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water. Cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Wisconsin is awash in water, cool, clear water, and it's the envy of drought-plagued states in the far west. Why, then, would a world-class trout stream, the Little Plover River, dry up completely one recent summer and be plagued by recurring water quality problems? The answer was confirmed in a study whose key findings were released Tuesday night. High-capacity wells necessary for agriculture and also industry and municipal government in the sensitive Central Sands region of Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, we're going to look at the implications of that study with UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft, whose own studies of the Little Plover River set the stage for the current one. Also, Tamas Houlihan, the executive director of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers Association, and two regional lawmakers, Republican Scott Krug of the town of Rome and Democrat Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point, who represent homeowners concerned about the impact of a mega dairy and other users who might have an impact on their own well water. We'll also hear from one of the key researchers involved in this new study, state geologist Ken Bradbury of UW Extension, and we'll hear from Dan Helsel. He's the natural resource manager for the Wisconsin DNR. We also want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments, you can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Thank you all for being with us today, especially on such short notice. I really appreciate it. So I'm going to do a round robin here. Your takeaway from the key findings that were released Tuesday night. George, let's start with you.
I think the big thing is that the work that's been going on for the past 50 years, and particularly the stuff that I've done in the last decade since the Little Plover first dried up, has been confirmed. And I'm hoping we can put the issue to bed whether or not pumping and surface waters, lakes and streams are connected, and start to discuss how we manage groundwater in the future so we don't have, or that we balance anyway, dried up lakes and streams with groundwater pumping.
Tamas Houlihan, the potato and vegetable growers have a real vested interest in keeping at least enough of those wells running so that your agricultural practices continue. Your reaction to the key findings of that study?
My initial reaction was I think it's premature to come out with that study. It's still undergoing a very serious portion of the study, which is the peer review. And I think it's important to finish that step in the process before we release findings. I mean, there is the potential for some of that information to change. And so until it is finalized, I really think it shouldn't have been released. However, there are some takeaways and some key findings that we already knew. We know there are impacts from pumping. However, there are a lot of other factors that play into it. And I guess our industry is working toward a solution. We want to make sure there's a balance between agricultural use and keeping healthy lakes and streams.
Now, that study is undergoing a peer review, the complete study, and Ken Bradbury, one of the lead researchers, said that he expected that it would be released in its finished form later this year. George Kraft, since you're the academic person here, tell us what a peer review is and tell us whether you think those key findings were premature, as Tamas obviously feels they were.
A peer review is something that where a document gets sent out to other experts in the field, and they dissect it, see if the underpinnings of the study are correct and the conclusions are correct. I was one of the many, many reviewers that were on it, in-state, out-of-state, elsewhere, and I got to see the compiled comments. And there's, you know, a number of tweaks that have been suggested and that sort of thing, but you know, nothing in there that I saw in the review comments that say that the conclusions that we saw presented on Tuesday were not correct.
Katrina Shankland, you're a Democratic Assemblywoman from Stevens Point. Your reaction to what you heard on Tuesday night?
Well, I was first of all very glad to see so many stakeholders in the room. I believe there are almost 350 people in attendance, and we've had other meetings like it where several hundred people have been in the room to hear from the DNR, the USGS, and other scientists about the research. And I think it's important to note that many studies have been done. Dr. George Kraft has done a lot of the groundwork for the Little Plover River study, and this model can be used to provide scientific support for future management decisions. So I think really when it comes down to studies and research, this is important data. It's important work, but studies are useless without policy. So what I would say is we need to actually use the data that's been collected to drive future legislative policy decisions.
And Scott Crew, you're a Republican representing the town of Rome, which has a lot of your constituents in it, upset about plans for a big dairy farm that's slated to go in there or is proposed, and they're concerned about groundwater. Your reaction to what you heard Tuesday night?
Well, I don't think it's any surprise to anybody in that room or in this room, as a matter of fact, that there is a connection between pumping and groundwater and surface water and the interconnectivity of all the water in our area. The challenge, you know, as Katrina just said, is to turn that research and that data into policy. And to turn that into policy, it's time to take politics out of the discussion and lay some groundwork as to how we're going to do that without throwing pot shots at each other and taking shots and wanting to take credit and all those types of things. I think the data and the conclusions are the things we've been talking about for 3 or 4 years already, and I think it's time that we just nail this thing down. We're really close on a lot of the discussion points we had between repair, replace, transfer, between the permissibility of, getting those permits into and the next generation. So I think a lot of the things we talked about this session are close to getting done next session. So I think we're going to get there.
Now, there were two lead researchers on the new Little Plover River study, Mike Feenan of the United States Geological Survey and also state geologist Ken Bradbury of UW Extension, who's also the director of the Wisconsin Geological Natural History Survey. There were more than 300 people at the event, as Katrina just said. And I talked briefly to Ken Bradbury that evening about why the study was necessary. Let's listen to what he had to say.
There was, as you know, a lot of controversy and disagreement about the cause of apparent low water levels in the Little Plover River and in lakes in central Wisconsin. A lot of finger-pointing at irrigation wells and so forth, and controversy about approving new irrigation wells. We, our survey, and the USGS, who are our partners here, are viewed as unbiased scientists who were asked to study this problem again and create a model, a decision support model, to help the DNR and others understand the constraints on the system and the impacts of individual wells. So that's what we've done.
How long did this take, and what was your methodology?
It took us about almost 2 years, and we've used some very standard groundwater flow models. The methodology was we collected some field data, we collected a lot of information like pumping rates from the wells, geologic properties of the ground, flow rates in the river, and we put those all together in a groundwater flow model and use the model to solve groundwater flow equations that then tell us how much water is discharged to the river, how wells are affecting water levels, and that sort of thing.
Why was it necessary to do this? George Kraft had already done a study of this phenomenon.
Well, that's right, and George has done some great work, as well as have people before him, and this place has been studied a long time, and it was a good place to try out some new techniques and to make a little more advanced model than George had done, although there's really nothing wrong with his model. I liken it to getting a new digital camera. You have more pixels, more resolution, so our model is like that. Our model is based on a numerical grid. Our grid is much finer than George had. We have more data than was available when he did it. Plus, it's always good in science to replicate each other's work.
How big of a problem are the high-capacity wells on the Little Plover River?
Well, they certainly do have an influence, and we can show that they do. They are influencing the river, yeah.
What are the recommendations?
We aren't making direct recommendations. That's for the DNR to do. We can show what the impacts of various management scenarios might be, such as changing land use, turning some wells off, or putting wells in different places. Those are all the kinds of things that this model can test.
So you're not making recommendations, but tell me what it will take to keep the Little Plover River healthy.
I think it will take a reduction in pumping or a reduction in water use. Now, that can be done by fewer wells or moving wells to different places or perhaps even different crops, probably a combination of things.
And that is Ken Bradbury, one of the lead researchers of the new study, whose key findings were released Tuesday night. And again, that complete report after a peer review will be released later this year. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you just joined us, we're talking to UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft, also Executive Director Tamas Houlihan of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers, and two representatives who have constituents in the area, Democrat Katrina Shankland and Republican Scott Krug. George Kraft, Ken Bradbury says the new study has more bells and whistles, or as he put it, more pixels than your earlier work, but it basically confirms your conclusions.
Yeah, I was really happy. He added a few new things that we saw on Tuesday night that I hadn't seen previously. I showed in our work a number of years ago, and Ken is correct that, you know, he's benefited from a lot of new data and such we didn't have. But I calculated that Little Plover River is missing 4.5 cubic feet per second of flow. He came up with 4.4 CFS. I was blown away that we had that kind of agreement.
What was a Little Plover like 60 years ago?
It had a lot more flow. You know, even in drought years, it had typically more flow than it does today in an average year. The fishery there was so productive that DNR, or Conservation Department staff at the time, used it as a study stream to understand why streams are so productive for trout and how they can make manipulations. It was a very highly prized water body.
Was it a destination for trout fishermen at the time? Because it certainly isn't now.
I don't know if it was a destination. I think, you know, a lot of locals fished it. I have a buddy who's in his 60s now. He used to make the trek from Stevens Point on his bike when he was a kid to fish the Little Plover River. But, you know, it was well known in trout circles and research circles.
And Ken Bradbury also said when my recorder wasn't running that there is no way the Little Plover River will ever be again what it was like 100 years ago, that things have changed too much, the environment has changed, the need for agriculture has changed, it's a more populated area. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think Ken was talking about this from a practical standpoint. Indeed, if we turned off all the wells and gave it some time, the Little Plover would be everything it is. There's still a very viable trout fishery in there. The fish are a lot smaller and sparser. But, you know, from a practical point of view, as Ken said, you know, from a societal side, we probably would expect that stream to be ratcheted back in its health from what it once was.
Just for the sake of our listeners, I'm going to go over these key findings really quickly here. First, the Little Plover River is closely connected to the groundwater system, making it vulnerable to impacts from nearby pumping. Second, water use in the basin varies through the year. About 80% of the total annual water use comes from irrigation pumping during the growing season. Land use and crop patterns affect recharge rates, which in turn impact groundwater levels and stream flows. The next point, pumping and land use changes have altered the natural groundwater flow pattern so that the capture zone, that's the area that contributes groundwater to the river, is smaller than it once was. The fifth point, wells outside the capture zone can still have a major impact. The sixth point, there can be a delay of weeks or months between changes in pumping and impacts on the river. The seventh point, a well's impact to the river depends primarily on its proximity to the river. For example, removing about 15 wells nearest the river would increase base flow substantially in an average year. Eight, the concept of depletion potential, the percentage of pumped groundwater that otherwise would have supplied flow to the river or lake, can help evaluate the relative impact of each well. So if I could just summarize that, you know, just based on the bullet points that seem significant to me, high-capacity wells impact the Little Plover. The closer a well is to the river, the more impact it has. Even if you shut a well off, the effects of the pumping continue to affect the river for weeks or months, and 80% of the high-capacity wells in the region are used for agriculture. Tamas, is there anything that I just said that you disagree with?
No, but I think there are some other solutions besides shutting off wells to have a balance between the need for agricultural irrigation and the need for a healthy trout stream. I walked the Little Plover Tuesday. I went on the land with Kurt Soik and Nick Summers, and we walked it and we looked at it, and it's flowing tremendously. There are trout in it. I don't think we need to shut off wells and reduce food production and hurt the agricultural economy and the economy of our entire state in order to have a healthy little plover. You just don't need to do that. And there are alternatives.
Ken Bradbury even mentioned changing the crops that you grow. But does that make sense given that the land is so suitable to potato production?
Well, it does when you talk about the proximity to the little plover. And our growers are already working on some steps whereby they can put less water-intensive crops closer to the little plover and move the more, you know, the crops that need more water a little bit further away.
Katrina, you've got a couple of things here. You've got natural resources, you've got groundwater, but you've also got a major economic impact, not just to central Wisconsin, but the entire state, our agriculture industry. People eat a lot of potatoes and vegetables. How do you balance those two needs?
That's a great question, and I would actually identify even more needs. Agriculture is an $88 billion industry in our state. They support 413,500 jobs. We also have tourism, which is an over $18 billion industry in our state, and recreation, our sporting heritage, whether it's members of Trout Unlimited or people who enjoy hanging out by the Little Plover River, I think those are all important considerations. We also have property owners. So there are dozens of lake associations who have been very active on this issue, and we have to think about property values in addition to tourism, recreation, agriculture, and other industries and the economies that they contribute to. So you're right, it's absolutely a lot of different considerations. I think one more consideration we need to add in is that enshrined in our state constitution is the Wisconsin Public Trust Doctrine, which does guarantee that all of our navigable waters are quote-unquote common highways, and they're forever free and held in the trust by the DNR. So we have, first of all, some case law related to our state constitution saying that our waterways, like the Little Plover River, do have to be forever free, and everyone in the state is entitled to them. So I think we have to consider that. There's also a case ruling that says that groundwater is not property. So we need to recognize the connection between groundwater and surface water and the fact that surface water is held in the public trust. So there are constitutional considerations when it comes down to access to these waterways. But in addition to that, there's the economy that I just mentioned. I think getting stakeholders together is priority number one. We already have the science. We already have the research. We already have the data, thanks to the work of many people, including Dr. Kraft. But the final thing that really needs to happen is a policy solution that leaves no one behind, a policy solution that we can all work with. And in Michigan and Minnesota, they've been able to bring everyone together, whether it was the pork producers, Trout Unlimited, vegetable growers. They were able to navigate those situations and issues, and I think we should do that here too.
Scott Krug, you're a Republican. Katrina Shankland is a Democrat. What do you agree with? What don't you agree with?
I agree with you that I'm a Republican. She's a Democrat. You know, a lot of the things she talked about are groundwork that have been laid. Those are things that have been discussed. We've had stakeholder meetings on both sides of the issue. One of the most fulfilling things about my job the last 6 years is to make all these friendships on both sides of this issue and to talk about all of these common themes across the entire Central Sands area and to try to figure out how to make policy work where geology changes. And that's where we try to come up with the sensitive resource area consideration to say, DNR, we want you to be able to go in and pinpoint in this area through predictive modeling exactly what you think you need to do in this area as opposed to an entire statewide policy that fits everybody. Because one-size-fits-all policy is not going to work in this discussion. It doesn't fit. What works in the Central Sands is not going to work in Anago. What works in Anago is not going to work down in Platteville. You know, there's different soils, different irrigation types, different levels of water being used. So everything we've talked about, there is some science out there that is useful right now. I'd love to see more predictive modeling done on more areas of the Central Sands. And if we talked the other night about the entire Sands area, that's great. My challenge is to not put too much too fast on the DNR so we can make sure that these decisions aren't 10 to 12 years down the road and give them something they can bite off right now that they can do in the next 3 to 5 years. So I've been preaching a little bit of patience to people to say we need more predictive modeling, we need more of these pinpoint pixelated views of what's going on all across the region. And those are the places the answers are going to come from. And the only bills that are ever going to get done are the comprehensive compromise solution bills. It's not going to be a one-sided bill. It's going to get done on either side. Frankly, both sides haven't liked very much what I've been working on the last couple of years, but that's the way good public policy goes.
Republican Scott Krug, Democrat Katrina Shanklin, two lawmakers from central Wisconsin, Tamas Houlihan, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers, and UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft. If you'd like to join the conversation, well, our phone lines are filled up right now, but I'm going to get to those phone calls right after this break. You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg. When we return, we'll also hear from Dan Helsel. He's the natural resource manager of the Wisconsin DNR. But first, here's a good friend of Route 51, Corky Siegel, with a song for the potato growers.
Well, there's something you should know before you bring me them vittles. I don't need nothing that don't bleed a little, that's right. It's got to wiggle in the pan. Cause I'm a carnivorian, not an Idaho potato man. Now don't you pick it from a tree, don't dig it out of the ground. I'll eat it if it moves and runs around, that's right. I'll catch it if you can. Cause I'm a New York steak, not an Idaho potato man.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like the Milwaukee Art Center and the Tommy Bartlett Show play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
Dire Straits taking us into the second segment of a panel discussion on the findings of a new study about high-capacity wells, the Little Plover River, and groundwater in the Central Sands region. Our guests, UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft, also Tamas Houlihan of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers, Republican Assemblyman Scott Krug of the Town of Rome, and Democratic Assemblywoman Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. We have a lot of people waiting patiently on the phone, so we're going to go there right now. Let's go to Don in the Town of Rome. Don, you're on with our panel.
Good morning. My name is Don Easthead. As Glenn mentioned, I'm a resident of Town of Rome, also a member of Scott Krug's disbanded Groundwater Advisory Committee. And that brings me to a question for Representative Krug. Realizing that the Little Plover study was due out in months, your vote moved out of committee and to the floor the Gudex groundwater bill, providing unlimited water rights in perpetuity to high-cap well owners, in spite of giving assurances to your constituents that you were working for them. Incidentally, many of those same constituents walked out on you Tuesday night when that question was posed to you. How do you justify moving that bill out of committee to your constituents and to the rest of the citizens in our state?
And we're going to go to Scott Krug, but the bill that Don is referring to, I believe, is Senate Bill 239.
Right.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Don, and I appreciate folks finally communicating to me about this directly. So here's what happens is when this bill comes up after AB 477 kind of bit the dust, we had a chance to try to make this bill a little bit better. So what we did with this bill is add provisions to add the largest hydrology study in state history. Basically, you're adding four entire new watersheds to exactly what the Little Plover study did. And this is entire watersheds within the Central Sands that we needed this data for. So I was very excited about getting those areas added to this predictive modeling that we need for some of these answers we need to come up with. The other parts of the bill that remained in place, the repair, the replace, and the transfer of ownership, as you remember from our Groundwater Advisory Committee time together, the group pretty much agreed that we need to make sure that growers can repair and replace and transfer the ownership of those wells, especially broken wells that need to be repaired in the middle of a dry season. So I think, you know, in the end, a lot of misinformation, a lot of conjecture goes into how evil the final answer could have possibly been. You know, we also added private rights for private well owners. So a lot of the things I wanted in 477, we tried to get added on to the Gudex bill in the end, not exactly as, you know, as fervently as they were in my bill, but when it's not your bill, you can only get so much done.
Don, do you have a quick follow-up?
No, not really. I think there may be others who may want to ask questions about that, so I'll defer to them.
All right. Don, thanks so much for the phone call, and there are others. Let's go to Rhonda right now in the town of Saratoga. Rhonda, you're on Route 51 with our panel.
Hi, this is Rhonda. My question comes after experiencing a lot of things, including, you know, I heard it mentioned that the Little Plover River is high right now after examination recently. You know, I saw just the opposite this past weekend in other bodies of water or places that there used to be water, with the Plainfield Lakes and Huron Lake being very, very low, even in spite of all of the precipitation we've had recently. I am wondering, as a resident of the town of Saratoga, where the Wasaki family of companies proposed a CAFO, high-capacity wells, 49 to start with, down to 33 now, and irrigated cropland throughout our community. I am wondering if it is possible for the Little Plover River study and the optimization model to be applied to Saratoga in the assessment with the EIS that we are currently in the process of.
All right. Thank you, Rhonda. Let's go to George Kraft for that. Can this predictive model that was done essentially for the Little Plover, to what extent can it be applied to the Central Sands region and the town of Saratoga?
We already have models of the Central Sands. The unique contribution of the Little Plover model was the optimization procedure and a couple other bells and whistles that, you know, we should, rather than reinvent wheels, we should transfer to existing models of Central Sands. Now, for the Saratoga situation, DNR, they have a new crew of young, eager, and talented hydrologists that are creating their own local model of the Saratoga area. I think it's going to be a good product. It's different than what was going on in the Little Plover, and it'll be interesting to see what they come up with when they release their EIS.
Rhonda, you're Rhonda Carell, correct?
Yes, I am.
You're a businesswoman in the town of Saratoga?
Yes, I am, and my business relies on water. If I don't have clean and plentiful water, I'm out of business.
How do you respond to people who say, as a businesswoman, you should be welcoming in the Wysocki Golden Sands Dairy Farm because of all the people it will be employing, and that should be good for your business?
Well, quite frankly, I am absolutely an advocate for growth of business. But when a business potentially takes away so much from the community that they wish to come into, essentially shutting down any type of other growth, having homeowners with depleted property values. We've already lost approximately $70,000 on our home during a recent reappraisal. And that's just at the proposal of this. The groundbreaking has not taken place. When you're looking at air quality issues, the handful of jobs that it might provide simply are not enough when it takes so much from a community.
All right.
It doesn't allow for growth.
Thank you, Rhonda. Tamas, this is the kind of thing that you hear anytime a large-scale agricultural or a dairy farm is located somewhere. As someone who's involved in the agricultural industry, what's your reaction to this opposition that you seem to get every time you try to put a large-scale farm somewhere?
Well, I'd be very interested to see what the environmental impact statement says. And I put the trust in our government to say yes or no, or if there are too many wells in a certain area, let's restrict the amount of pumping. Let's have a balance. let's make sure that whatever the DNR approves is not going to harm the environment, but let's not thwart business and let's not stop producing food and milk. I mean, we are positioned in a location with a tremendous amount of water, and I think we have a responsibility to use that water and use it wisely. We are growing healthy vegetables for a hungry world, and we're going to have to do more of it as time goes on. Our population is exploding. We're going to need more food from less land. And absolutely, we don't want to pollute the environment. These farmers live on their land. They raise their families on their land. They want what's best for the environment and for the people and for the economy. I think there is a balance that we can achieve.
Rhonda, thank you so much for the phone call. Let's go now to Brian in Wisconsin Rapids. Brian, you're on Route 51. Hello, Brian. Brian, I know you're there because I can hear your radio.
Here.
All right, turn the radio down and your question, please, for our panel.
Okay, just a quick observation. We've basically got six groups at the table regarding this, the water issue in the Central Sands. We've got the public, we've got the growers, two political parties, we've got the DNR, and then we've got the outside science community like Mr. Kraft. Four of the six obviously have a firm grasp and an acknowledgement of cumulative effect. As evidenced by some of the verbiage in the raft of legislation that was proposed this last session, some of it actually by Mr. Krug, it's obvious that two of these groups haven't joined reality yet. My question for Mr. Houlihan and Mr. Krug is, when can we expect this transition so that the meaningful conversation can finally get started? I'll hang up and then I'll answer, or I'll listen to your answers.
All right, Brian, thanks so much. Let's go to Scott Krug and then Tamas.
So when we talk about reality of the situation, we have to understand that when we talk cumulative impacts and the reality of cumulative impacts, that cumulative impact assessment is not needed everywhere in the state of Wisconsin. So the only thing that happened with legislation regarding cumulative impact is we left it in place in the most targeted areas of need in the state of Wisconsin. Didn't take it away completely, just said where we don't need to do it right now, let's not do it right now and focus all of our DNR resources in areas where we need to do cumulative impact assessments. That included a vast area in the Central Sands area. That includes all these areas we're talking about in the SRA process, where all these areas we're talking about in the interim SRA process that we created. So when people talk about the reality of the situation, we need to read the legislation and understand that cumulative impact assessment was not going away.
Now, in 2014, a state administrative law judge, Thomas Bolt, ruled against the DNR in a suit that was brought regarding the $35 million Richfield Dairy Farm, and he ruled that the DNR was wrong because it failed to consider the cumulative effects of groundwater use when they reviewed the application for a high-capacity well.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that apply to all cases in the state of Wisconsin?
It does right now, and that was the point of the legislation, is to say if we're going to go through and put DNR staff and resources into doing cumulative impacts, let's do it on the most difficult cases instead of every case. These are expensive, time-consuming circumstances that aren't always necessarily needed in Antigo, for example, that may be needed in Coloma. So when we talk about cumulative impacts and where they're needed, we put up a process that said we're going to do them here automatically. We're going to do them here once you're in an interim SRA process. And if you need to get your area back into an SRA-designated area, here's a process that everybody can use to apply to get back under that protection. When you talk in the day and age of budgets and the way that some of the budgets for DNR have gone in the past few years, and people say they have limited resources because of some of the things that were done, it only makes sense to target those resources to the areas of most need.
Katrina Shanklin, why don't you weigh in on what you just heard?
Sure. I actually don't think that makes sense at all. I think when you look at the state constitution, I mentioned the public trust doctrine earlier, the ALJ, the administrative law judge's decision on Richfield Dairy, was partially based on, you know, the waters of our state and the connection between surface water and groundwater. And that's why he ruled that the DNR absolutely has the authority to consider cumulative impacts. This isn't – our water decisions shouldn't be based based on politics, on where you live, on what part of the state you decide as a legislator that you want to be able to have water resources. Any policy decision that's made and put in place should be put in place for the future for our generations to access water. And just because there may not be a problem in Antigo right now doesn't mean there couldn't be in the future. So if we're going to be applying the law, it needs to be applied equally. And I think any legislation like Representative Krug's, which would take away the DNR's authority to consider cumulative impacts when permitting high-capacity wells, would actually, I would say, argue it could undermine our state constitution, but it also undermines the whole point of public policy on these decisions. This is about future generations and their right to access our surface waters and groundwater.
So Scott Krug?
Can I ask a question then? Let me just ask you this, Katrina. Do you believe in the ability of the growers to repair, replace, and reconstruct wells that have gone bad during the growing season?
I think that the cumulative impact proposal in your bill had absolutely nothing to do with repair, replace, and transfer. And what I'll say about the repair, replace, and transfer legislation is that no environmental group and no stakeholder group, whether it was concerned citizens in the Central Sands or the environmental advocacy groups across the state, no one was disputing the need for some kind of policy related to it. However, what they did dispute and what I agree with is this concept of permanent water rights for some people at the expense of water rights for others. This isn't the Wild West. So when you allow some people to have the DNR never be able to come in and look, do periodic review, maybe every 10 years, to look at the issues related to groundwater and surface water, which again are guaranteed by our Constitution, what you're really doing is you're saying, you know, if you have a well that dries up next door, you're out of luck. And that's really unfortunate because, you know, the rhetoric today and every day is about balance. But there's no balance if some people have no water rights and other people have all of them. So we have to be clear about this. Everyone deserves the same right to access our water, period.
Scott Krug, a quick rebuttal.
Because every single Democrat in the Senate signed on as a co-sponsor of an amendment to the GUDEX bill that did the exact repair, replace, and transfer of ownership without the periodic review. So when we talk about rhetoric, let's look at what was exactly proposed in both houses. It was exactly the same thing. No periodic review required for repair, replace, transfer of ownership. So we got to stop talking about, you know, who didn't have a problem with it, who's okay with it, and we only wanted periodic reviews when the entire Senate Democratic Caucus didn't even propose periodic review, and it wasn't proposed in the Assembly
that's
either.
That's incorrect. They actually
Senate
did.
Senate Amendment 4.
They introduced another amendment, Representative Krug, that would actually require periodic review. So let's be honest.
So they proposed both ways.
You can introduce more than one amendment to a bill.
Oh, so you can vote for an amendment for a bill and then not support the bill in the end?
Your amendment literally passed and was the bill.
Oh, because no Assembly Republicans had or no Assembly Democrats decided to offer any legislation or amendments?
I think that we care more about creating legislation that complies with our state constitution.
But you didn't create any legislation is my point.
The point is that Representative Mason and Senator Miller actually have put forward a comprehensive groundwater proposal. It's called the Water Sustainability Act. And what that bill does is it provides, I think, a meaningful solution for communities across the state. It gives local control to communities, including a groundwater coordinating council that would determine based on science-based criteria whether or not an area should be designated as a groundwater management area. The DNR would come in and be able to develop a management plan. They'd be able to work with all stakeholders. And most importantly, it would ensure that the DNR could look at cumulative impacts of wells, as well as the adverse environmental impacts on all waters of the state. Now, this is consistent with case law. This is consistent with court decisions. This doesn't undermine our Constitution. Everyone would be able to comply with it. It wouldn't put anyone out of business. And most importantly, it would guarantee what I think public policy needs to have. Everyone should have the same rights and the same access.
That's great, because that's what we did with AB 477. So now we agree on repair, replace, transfer of ownership, and a regional approach to groundwater through either the SRA concept or the groundwater management areas.
Right.
So there's full agreement on those areas.
Let's not put words in my mouth. I totally disagree with you because you have eliminated an important court decision that could undermine the Constitution if your bill were to
all
pass.
All right. We're gonna stop it right here. I'm going to get a reaction from Tamas Houlihan. Cumulative effects. Is this something that should be considered every time a high-capacity well is repaired or replaced?
Well, and I want to get back to the caller who asked about the reality of the situation. And the reality is the DNR has a huge backlog of high-capacity well permit applications. due to budget cuts and due to the fact that they are now required to take a look at cumulative impacts whenever a new high-capacity well is proposed, they are not able to do their jobs. They don't have the time. They don't have the money. They don't have the people. They simply don't have the resources to do these cumulative impact studies on all these well permit applications. And so I think we need to come up with some kind of reasonable legislation that says, okay, if you are in a sensitive resource area, we are going to have to take a look at that, and that one's going to take some time. If you're in another area where your well went bad, it's not because it ran out of water. It's because wells break down. They're like any piece of equipment. They fail. They need to be replaced. A crop can be lost within 24 hours. We have to allow our growers to repair and replace. And in transfer of ownership, you're not changing anything about the well. The impact of repair, replace, and transfer on new pumping was zero. There's no new pumping, no new water used. These are already approved, DNR-approved wells.
George Kraft?
Wow, there's a lot there. First of all, I think that there seems to be a boogeyman about the backlog at DNR. Talking to my DNR colleagues, they say where a well can go in the state and there's not cumulative impacts already, things go through pretty quickly. But the problem is we're trying to put approve more wells going into areas that are already impacted, and this takes a lot of analysis. So, you know, do we in Wisconsin want to say, well, we'll continue, we're in a hole, we'll continue to dig deeper holes here by approving more wells, or do we want to do this a little more thoughtfully?
You're listening to a panel discussion on the findings of a new study about high-capacity wells, the Little Plover River, and groundwater in the Central Sands region. Our guests, UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft, also Tamas Houlihan of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers, Republican Assemblyman Scott Krug of the Town of Rome, and Democratic Assemblywoman Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a short break, but first, here are the Beach Boys with a song about their favorite vegetables.
If you brought a big brown bag of them home, I'd jump up and down and hope you'd toss me a carrot. I'm gonna keep well my vegetables cart off and sell my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include the Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum, Hotel Red, and Visit Milwaukee. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Details at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Hanson's Garden Village in Rhinelander, a full-service garden center offering sustainable landscape design and installation, village-themed greenhouses filled with plants and ideas. Hanson'sGardenVillage.com.
River, river, she come down. River, river, she come down. You travel up the river, you travel.
Friend of Route 51, Peter Yarrow, also Noel Paul Stuckey, and Mary Travers take us into the final segment of a panel discussion on the findings of a new study about high-capacity wells, the Little Plover River, and groundwater in the Central Sands region. With our guests, UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft, Tamas Houlihan of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers, Republican Assemblyman Scott Krug of the Town of Rome, and Democratic Assemblywoman Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. We have still callers waiting for us, so we're going to get to Pat in the Town of Rome. Pat, you're on Route 51 with our panel.
I'd like to address a question to Mr. Houlihan. I just received the United Nations study on world water. According to them, 20% of the world's aquifers are presently overexploited. They claim that industrial agriculture is the greatest misuse of water today. By 2030, they're projecting a 40% in deficit in global groundwater worldwide. Now, Mr. Houlihan said they have to feed the world. The United Nations advocates smaller family farms will produce greater yield on less land. Why are the vegetable growers and the dairy farmers advocating an antiquated paradigm that is not working, especially with the dairy business. It's producing more manure that has no place to go. They're spreading it on crops way too deep and too much. It's overflowing into our lakes and our streams. How do you justify the fact that there is a better way to farm
Pat,
worldwide?
We got it, Pat.
And you're not even trying to do anything about it.
Pat, we got it. Let's let Tamas Houlihan respond. Tamas?
Well, I respectfully disagree with that opinion. I do not believe that we are going to be able to feed the world with small family farms. If you think you can do that, what you are doing is turning your back on the urban centers. You're turning your back on your neighbors in Milwaukee, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. Those people do not have, you know, four-acre farms where they can raise their own chickens and raise their own vegetables. It absolutely won't work. If you look at the science, you are going to need to produce more food on less land, and production agriculture is the way to do it. And let me say one other thing. These are family farms. These are not corporate factory farms. They are family farmers. I know these people. They live and they work and they raise their family on the land on which they live.
Pat, thanks so much for the comment. And we've got to go to some Facebook comments right now. I want to get everybody in if we can. Jim on Facebook, study shows the wells have caused a disruption of the Plover River flow and lowered the groundwater aquifer 2 to 6 feet every year. Agricultural irrigation is responsible for over 80% of this. Why don't we have all the shareholders on your program, that's all four of you, agree today to a moratorium on all future well permits for the study area. Let's start with Tamas once again.
I don't think that's responsible. I think there is a way to balance the need for irrigated agriculture with the need for healthy lakes and streams.
George Kraft?
Well, if they're talking the study areas, the Little Plover, you know, we need to accept if you put in another well and you have more water consumption without ratcheting something else back, you're going to exacerbate the impacts. There's kind of no two ways about it.
Katrina Shanklin?
I think he should also consider that there are ways to conditionally permit existing wells, and that's why we need DNR periodic review.
Scott Krug?
No moratoriums. We've seen moratoriums in different issues across the state. It doesn't work. When you talk about a moratorium for high-capacity wells or a moratorium on sand mining or moratoriums for all these other things, those are Band-Aid solutions. We need to come up with good public policy based on scientific research, and that's exactly what we're working on right now. So the word moratorium is like fingers on a chalkboard to me.
And Matt on Facebook, how has the appointment of Secretary Stepp, she is the head of the DNR, affected our ability to not only study issues such as this, but also to respond to data in a thoughtful, timely, open manner? George Kraft, you don't work for the DNR, so I'll let you respond.
You know, I don't know so much that's the appointment of Secretary Stepp, but, you know, a change and a deliberate change in the way the executive branch wants the Department of Natural Resources function. So, you know, in the time that I've been around, I see our Department of Natural Resources be less proactive about issues. I think the other thing, you know, the Richfield Dairy case was an embarrassment for the agency because they really did a poor job at evaluating the information that was come in. And I think they were the good people there were hamstrung from doing that.
George Kraft, a final comment from you. We are completely out of time.
Oh, boy. We got to dig into this issue. It's been 50 years since we started studying this thing. It's 11 years ago since the Little Plover first dried up. We're, you know, digging more groundwater holes in other parts of the state. You know, whether we decide to sacrifice our streams or manage pumping, you know, whatever our policy may be, it's time to get around to it.
Tamas Houlihan?
It's going to take research, and it's going to take science, and I think we can do it. I know that our growers embrace technology. They're progressive. They're proactive. They're looking at ways to maybe do things more efficiently. We are producing a lot more potatoes on about one-fourth of the land.
Katrina Shanklin?
The Little Plover River is but one example of water bodies that are experiencing adverse effects of a tremendous amount of high-capacity wells. And I think we need to look at other water bodies as well. This isn't just about the river. And so we need to pass good public policy. We need everyone at the table. In Madison, I feel as if there were really only a few stakeholders at the table. So next session, we really do need to have a thoughtful conversation that actually complies with the state constitution. And here's how the citizens of Wisconsin. I agree. I think the DNR bears responsibility as well. We need leadership from them.
Scott Krug, you've got the final word.
Well, I just want to thank everybody for taking the time over the last few years and today to discuss this issue. I think, we're close. We worked with every stakeholder group we could find. We've talked to everybody about this issue. We are just a few small tweaks away from getting a comprehensive compromise solution that everybody can agree on. So thanks, Glenn, again.
We want to thank today's guests, UW Extension hydrologist George Kraft, Executive Director Tamas Houlihan of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers, Republican Assemblyman Scott Krug, and Democratic Assemblywoman Katrina Shanklin. Thanks also to State Geologist Ken Bradbury for his contribution to the program. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our Executive Producer Rick Ryer, our on-air producer Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Al Green, the Sons of the Pioneers, Corky Siegel, Dire Straits, the Beach Boys, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Hoagy Carmichael. Next week on Route 51, we talk to three visiting students from Tunisia and get their perspectives on the Arab Spring, the problem of terrorism, and their impressions as Muslim observers of America's electoral process. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.
Lingering in the shade of a kind old tree.